Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Luis Cuende. Luis is the co-founder of Aragon, a project for disintermediating the creation and maintenance of companies and other organizational structures. He is also the co-founder of Stampery, an advisor to many other blockchain projects, including Decentraland, and a former advisor to the European Commission. Luis won the coding competition Hack Forward at the age of 15, and Forbes selected him as one of the 30 people under 30 in technology in Europe. And now, to the interview. Hi, Luis, and many thanks for taking time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Luis, with Aragon, one of your goals is, and I paraphrase here, is to be the first community-governed, decentralized organization whose goal is to act as a digital jurisdiction that isn't bound to traditional artificial barriers, such as national jurisdictions or the borders of a single country. Now, how exactly will that work?
Well, I think something very important is we are creating these smart contracts, and smart contracts are very, very useful. But there are situations in which you just need governance and you just need humans. And so, for example, if you can do a payroll contract with a smart contract, that's wonderful. But then if you need your employer to check if you have, I don't know, given your work laptop back or something like that, a smart contract cannot make sure of that. So you need to have this like layer two of governance or dispute resolution. And that's what we want to do with the Aragon network. So with Aragon itself, we want to make decentralized organizations, DAOs, happen. But then with the Aragon network, we want to make sure that they can be widespread and they can be mainstream because we can create this governance layer on top of the blockchain. Mm-hmm.
But it says it isn't bound by any artificial barriers such as national jurisdictions. But the company is still here in Switzerland, right?
Yeah, the foundation and the company are legal entities right now, and we have a plan to transition those out to DAOs. But of course, we have to make software so DAOs can exist for us to be able to transition. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, and it's just like taking time to develop the software.
Okay, but exactly that chicken and egg problem kind of interests me. I mean, how do you decouple the physical location from, you know, all the operations?
What we are thinking is for the nonprofit entity, for example, we want to decentralize its governance. So for example, when Jorge or me, who right now are the people that can do transactions and spend money, we decide that it is time to give, you know, ANT holders, token holders, power over veto of how we spend those funds, then we will have to, you know, make a transaction and then wait for token holders to veto or not veto. And that's like a first step, right? You are integrating a legal entity, but you are having some governance over the funds that token holders can do, and they can exercise that governance power. I would say second or third step is fully transitioning that out. So Jorge or me are not like needed anymore. And you just have like a network of token holders that can decide how to spend the funds. And that's something that we will start doing with like a small experiments, basically creating a DAO, putting some funds in there and seeing how token holders use it. And if people actually, you know, use it for the long term and they invest the funds in a wisely manner, then I think we can fully transition to token holders having that power. And how that works in the legal realm is kind of interesting because, and I have talked to this with my lawyers, and it's very funny because like you're basically saying we want to give a grant of a lot of money to a DAO, which has no legal entity at all. You cannot invoice it. It doesn't really exist in the traditional world. And that's something that is super, super interesting. And we're still like doing legal research, but I think it is totally doable.
How do you think it's doable?
Well, I think what you can do is you can give a grant to an entity, right? Because in the end, it's kind of a grant. You are just picking this organization, and this organization is composed by a huge number of token holders, and you're giving it a grant. Now, this organization doesn't have an explicit legal entity, but you could consider that it's an aggregation of all token holders, right? So there's kind of an area there in which you can argue that you're giving funds to this pool of token holders, and you are doing so because they are part of the community. So that's kind of the legal angle that we're thinking about. It's still very experimental, and I think will take like probably 6 months to like a year to actually have something that we can start with in terms of like, you know, playing with governance with token holders. But that's like the angle we're taking.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're also advising another project called Decentraland. Now, can you briefly describe what that project is about?
Sure. So Decentraland is something super cool. It is a digital land that is fully owned by people. So basically, you have this fully digital world in which you truly own the land and no one can take it from you. Unlike, you know, traditional systems in which you own land and people can go with guns and basically kick you out. So that's super interesting. And also you can build the stuff. It has like a developer SDK and you can build the stuff. The main difference, I think, is that in the digital realm, you have zero marginal cost. You don't necessarily need to pay for each bit or each pixel that you construct in this world because, you know, it's digital. You can basically replicate or clone everything for free. So I think that's super cool for creativity and like, you know, just having a lot of human creation. And I think VR, like down the line, maybe 10 years from now, we will certainly spend a couple hours per day for sure in a VR world.
What was that called? Second Life?
Yeah, Second Life. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, were you part of that as well? Or
I think I tried out, but I wasn't like never into it very much. I think because it was super early technology-wise. Like VR these days is amazing, and it's getting even better. And if we have other sensors, we may be able to replicate like, our human experience with a machine, which is kind of crazy and a bit dystopian at the same time. But I think like you can do a lot of good stuff with it. And we can end with violence in all situations because there is no violence in VR.
I mean, that's one thing I always read when I read about your projects, the projects that you're involved in, and also the posts and articles that you write. It's also always about freedom. It's for people to take their control about their life and, you know, make the most of what they have. And I mean, sometimes when I look around, I feel many people don't even appreciate, you know, all the freedoms that they have in the physical world. So how do you make sure that, you know, people actually want what you're building?
It's a very hard question. It's same with like privacy. It's same with a lot of other values. It's same with what we are doing in Aragon. Like, how do we convince people or how do we explain people the benefits of having fully decentralized, unstoppable organizations? And I think there are a couple of ways. One way is just to make the experience even better than traditional services. So people, instead of using Facebook, they would use Akasha or other decentralized social platform, for example, because the experience is better. And apart from that, the experience can be better because it is interoperable. Like all software that we are creating in this blockchain world is open source by default, because if it's not open source, you cannot trust it. And so by it being open source, you can reuse any component that you want, playing with other apps or other services and create new stuff. And you cannot do that with a traditional web model. Like you cannot just consume data off Facebook without even asking Facebook for permission. And I think that's super revolutionary. The second part is explaining why these values matter. And I think we need to explain it with like long-term examples of things that, because I mean, these things, they don't fail in the short term, they fail in the long term after, you know, this power corrupts over the years and then scandals happen and a lot of that. So we should remember people why and how these things happen. And we have a lot of good examples with the US, with the NSA, with Donald Trump. So I don't think it's very hard to explain that to people.
I mean, the technology is one thing, right? That's interesting maybe to people who build technology themselves. But I think I'm always interested in these narratives, right? Why should we care about all of that? And so, I mean, you mentioned some of the examples, right, with the US, with data abuse. What are other stories that you see work well when you talk about your projects?
I think China is very scary too. It's very scary. I think China has the next level of privacy invasion, even worse than the US. I never been to China, but the stories I've heard and in the news that I have looked at are pretty scary.
Like you mean that citizen score?
Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. It's kind of crazy. Like the first time I saw it, I thought it was a joke. And also, for example, the new programs that they are doing to like prevent you from committing a crime before you actually do it, which sounds a little bit like Minority Report. So I think this, like China is super scary, is a good example of how not to be.
What other stories?
I mean, I have pretty bad memory myself, but I think there are a lot of stories, not only with governments, but in general with populations that go south and they go crazy and delusional. I think the Nazis are another example. Like a lot of people, they didn't really know that they were part of like the bigger picture of like the Nazi, apocalypse or genocide, but they were. And so it's important to remember people that they should know the values that they stand for. And they should know how these governments work, and they should know all of that. Because otherwise, they can be manipulated. And even if it wasn't their first intention, they can arrive to do terrible things at humanity. And that's happening with a lot of, you know, that maybe the Nazis were like the bigger example, but like you have examples like Donald Trump, people who stand for individual freedom, and they vote for Donald Trump. There's a huge dissonance in there. And there's a huge dissonance because people people in governments in general, they use this power to control and to try to shape thoughts in people's mind. And that's super, super scary because like you change the meaning of words, basically. And then you just can change people however you want.
Another goal of Aragon is to provide the tools for anyone to become an entrepreneur and run their own organization to take control of their own lives. And of course, that too, right? It's easier said than done because being an entrepreneur is a very hard thing. And it's much harder than many people think, maybe even before they embark on that path. So how do you get people excited to do these things?
I think something that worked out very well for us was the video that we released. We released a video, a very revolutionary video, trying to resume...
It was like a Hollywood movie.
It was like a Hollywood movie, exactly. Trying to like summarize what we are doing, what we are doing. And I think that's super important, the first steps in crypto. Like I see a lot of projects that are just trying to excite people with their code. And I think code is awesome. Like we have a super top technical team. But apart from that, we are not here just for the code, right? We are here to change society and to make it better. And so that's important that you always precede code with words and narratives and actually why you're building things, kind of the motivation behind it. So we try to share that as much as possible. Also, I would say transparency, it's super important. We are super transparent with finances, transparent with the governance, transparent with like everything we do at the project. And I feel that people really, really, really like feel a part of the project because of that. They know what's going on, they know that they can have a say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it really resonates, right? If you give people the opportunity to take control of their destiny and take control of their life. Was there for you personally, was there ever a time where you didn't feel in control?
Well, I would say back in the day when I was at school, like you don't feel in control there because basically you are in a dictatorship. Like you have like a teacher that says what you should like put in your brain and whatnot, basically. And if you disagree, well, you cannot disagree basically. Like at least in Spain when I was born, you have to go to school until you are 16. If you don't go, like police come to your house and they take you to school. That's what happens. So for me, like I didn't feel free at all because like I was literally being put stuff in my head, in my brain, having to remember stupid stuff or data that I will not ever use. And that doesn't feel like free at all. So I think that was one example. Another example is like my family has had some issues with like banking systems in general. And I think that it's just like you don't feel free if like there's a bank that can go and kick you out of home. Like that's obviously another.
What kind of issues were those?
Well, it's like the usual issues in like around 2008 or stuff like that, right? The subprime crisis and banks trying to kick out people from home. It's a huge problem in Spain too, like banks just go and try to kick people out because they haven't paid or whatever. And they haven't paid because they have been totally, basically ripped off by banks during decades. So it is not weird that they cannot pay.
What do you think is, if you look around in society and how it works or maybe doesn't work, what do you think are the biggest threats here, you know, in Europe or in general in the West?
I think the huge trend of people trying to be like very racist in general, I think that's a huge issue because they are trying to attribute their problems to immigrants while their problems are themselves, actually. So I think that's very, very disturbing. Even in Europe, which Europe used to be like a politically very advanced society, and now like everyone is saying, oh, these immigrants are going to take my jobs, whatever. And it doesn't make any sense. And I think that's very scary. And the underlying problem is that people haven't realized that jobs are a thing of the past. Like the economy doesn't grow because we grow a lot of jobs. I think a good example is a politician will get more votes if the politician says that they will create more jobs and replace machines with humans. But the economy will actually be hurt because you're putting a bottleneck. You're putting like an artificial bottleneck there. You're putting humans where it should be machines. And so I think people are not realizing that. And they are, instead of trying to realize that and interiorize that there will not be more easy jobs for them, they are saying that just like immigrants are taking their jobs, which is, I would say computers are taking their jobs and they should be okay with that.
But for many people, I think for you, it's obvious, right? If computers take a job, I mean, because you write a lot of the software with computers. So for you, it's not scary. But I mean, can you understand that somebody may be scared by that kind of vision?
I can understand completely. And I think there are two options. You either go and make software yourself and you make yourself a part of all of it, or you push for a universal basic income, which I think it's a very good alternative. And like there's been some experimentation in countries like Finland, but there hasn't really been any push for governments just saying we're going to have universal basic income right now. And I think that's what a lot of governments should do. Instead of wasting money in corruption, they should probably try out basic income and see how it plays out.
Do you think blockchain technology can alleviate some of these problems in society?
I think so. Blockchain enables transparency to a huge new level. And so I think if citizens put pressure on their governments to actually be more transparent, that would be great. I don't think that will happen very soon because, of course, there are problems in a lot of corrupt governments. They just want to keep being corrupt. So the cool thing is you don't have to ask for permission. You can use blockchain to organize and self-organize with people, and you don't have to ask for permission to the government or any other entity. So that's super cool. And I think in general, that will increase transparency in whole society because you can just, you know, add someone to your organization and start playing with that person, start creating value, and no one knows.
Mm-hmm. But what about the racism that you said before? I mean, do blockchains have a role in, you know, helping with that as well?
I would say so. I think blockchains are the huge manifestation of internationalization. And so the internet kind of is a demonstration of that too, but like blockchain is a huge other level. For example, with legal stuff, the blockchain completely changes the paradigm. Like, for example, if you have some image or some copyright music or whatever that is on the blockchain, all nodes have it. Does that make all the nodes illegal because they are running that, you know, that some bytes that are copyright or whatever? It's kind of blows your mind as a lawyer, and I think also removes the need for borders, and it kind of makes the point that borders are a joke even more clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I mean, I'm not sure that borders are the problem with racism. You know, it's maybe different things. It's maybe more psychology of people. It's fear of things they don't understand, and I'm just wondering, you know, how in the end, you know, how effective will the system that you're just describing be at combating, you know, those issues?
Yeah, I would say borders are fundamentally what creates racism, because if you didn't have borders, you wouldn't have countries. And like a lot of the problems, and most of the problems actually, is that people have pride for their flag. And it's a very unjustified pride, because I always put the example of like borders in general. Like if someone is assigned in the border inside Spain, that will report that in all like TV news. If that person is killed like 100 meters in the France border, that is not news anymore. So it's just like super nonsense. It's like tribalism.
Another point that you're making with Aragon is, and I paraphrase again, by making it possible for everyone in the world to organize, we're enabling a borderless, permissionless, and more efficient creation of value. So how do you see that happen?
Well, I think the first step is having decentralized organizations. If you can just open an app and create value and distribute that value to people without having to go through an intermediary.
But that value creation, actually, I'm interested in. How will that unfold?
Yeah, I think my favorite example is, for example, someone who wants to get into free software and make money out of free software consulting. And so I always put the example of a girl in Venezuela like a, you know, it can be done like a, like an underage person, because if you're underage, you cannot even create legal forms. And in Venezuela, everything is so corrupt that you probably cannot even if you are overage. But imagine like a 16-year-old girl in Venezuela organizing with like a 14-year kid in, I don't know, Sudan or whatever. And they are very talented software developers, but they are just discriminated because of their age. They are discriminated because of the countries that they live in. And both systems, like today, I don't think you can like interoperate if you are from these two countries at all. Or it maybe requires a lot of bureaucracy and it will be impossible. With Aragon, they can just create an organization. If they know each other, I don't know, from an internet forum, whatever, they can create an organization. They're going to start working on consulting services for companies or in general, like creating value. And then they can distribute that value out. And everything is transparent and self-enforceable. They don't have to rely on any commercial registry or company or whatever. It's just like so flawless and so easy.
I want to ask a little bit more about the ICO. So you I think you made an ICO in 2017, right?
Yeah.
At the beginning. And you raised 275,000 Ether. So roughly today, I think it's over $100 million, I guess. So, I mean, was there ever a point where that amount of money scared you?
Well, I would say like in January this year, Ether went to 1,000K. And so the amount of money that Aragon had was kind of crazy.
Like a quarter of a billion or something like
yeah,
that.
It was just nuts. I didn't even look at it. It was just like, what is going on? I think on the other hand, like it's super useful for grants. We have a grants program for both like smaller grants from people that are building on Aragon or like Ethereum scalability, stuff like that. And also like another grants program that we are going to announce for other teams to build on Aragon. So I could say, you know, if we have more money, we can have more reach and we can give more grants. That's basically like the edge. But yeah, certainly like when Ether goes up, it's just like crazy. You know, I think it's the other way around too, right? If it goes down, you are scared because it goes down. So certainly we need to do a little bit of treasury management.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own, the Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes, so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. How do you do that, I'm wondering? You know, how do you hedge against the price going down too much?
Well, you can hedge against other cryptos, or you can hedge against like other kind of assets in the market. You have like super traditional assets like, well, fiat, or you can have like stocks or gold. I think there are multiple ways.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think of converting everything into fiat? And
no, we haven't thought of that. I mean, we are here because we love crypto, and so we are willing to take the risk. Also, I think we have like a huge chunk of the Ethereum network, and we want to be a part of Ethereum, and we want to stake when proof of stake is out, and we want to like, you know, be a part of the ecosystem. So I think having Ether puts us in a very good position for being part of the Ethereum ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And all the grants you make are also in Ether?
Yeah, they are in Ether. Yeah, they are denominated in fiat, but we make the payouts in Ether.
You also wrote a post about Facebook and their filtering algorithm on your personal blog, and there just briefly I summarize what you said. Your point was that filtering fake news would make Facebook even more into a kind of a dictator, because it would give them even more power, and the service to the users of Facebook would actually be negative. So now, I mean, I remember when Facebook came up, and many people who were very educated and very libertarian had high hopes for it, you know, and nobody could have imagined that all these weird things happened. And even maybe, you know, Mark Zuckerberg didn't mean evil. And so how do you, with your decentralized platforms, how do you make sure that you're not going down that path?
I think you make sure by decentralizing power, because if you look at what happened to Facebook, I don't know if Mark was well-intentioned or not. That's super hard to know. But I think what happens anyway is that you have shareholders, and then you have incentives that are misaligned between investors who want to profit from users and users who want to use the platform for free and, you know, just use it. And I think with these crypto communities, what we are seeing is a convergence of the two. So if you are a token holder, you may be there because of like speculation, but most importantly, you are there because you want to be a user. So I think that's super, super important, and that changes how you build incentives, because you're building for your users first and then for other kind of subgroups of the users. And also you have to give control to the users and to the community, because otherwise like power corrupts, and that's something that has been demonstrated for 1,000 times in history. So
but,
I think...
But sorry to interrupt there. Isn't that what also Facebook set out to do?
Well, setting out to do and doing is, you know, they're very different things. So I think they wanted to do that. They are always like, we love users, we respect their privacy. But then if you have no incentive in place to do that, you end up not doing it.
So you think it was shareholder pressure that got them down that dark path?
I would think so. I would think it's shareholders pressure, also like the government. Like, I mean, in Qtel, like the arm of the NSA that invests in companies, they have invested in multiple like startups that we all know, and big companies like Google. And they have done that for a reason, right? It's to have power over them.
Mm-hmm. But your token investors, they also want to make a return, right? So they may at some point also try to nudge maybe the system into ways that weren't intended in the beginning. I mean, couldn't that happen as well?
I would say you have to architect your community in a way that they care for long-term value creation. And I mean, we all want long-term value creation because, I mean, it's good for everyone in the community that they are able to use the platform, they are able to use it the way they want, and they are able to, you know, feed their families and contribute and get something in return. But on the other hand, I don't think you want like short-term flippers, and we have seen a lot during last year. So, I think what we're trying to do, for example, with our communities, we're trying to keep it super, super developer focused and user focused. So you can either talk about governance mechanisms or like, you know, proposals to make the product better. But we're not there to talk that you want to like do a 2x in 2 days or whatever. That's just like out of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Luis, what's your favorite book?
I would say right now it is The Sovereign Individual.
Mm-hmm. By whom?
I don't remember the authors. It was kind of two very libertarian VCs.
Okay. I thought maybe you said 1984.
I would say that's also a very good one, but like I have very short-term memory, so like I just remember the last one I read, and it was mind-blowing. I think The Sovereign Individual is mind-blowing for everyone that wants to get into crypto or know more about crypto. It was a book written in, I think, like 20 years ago or even 30, and describes perfectly how crypto would work before crypto. It's mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the same with 1984, right? Which I'm sure you've read by George Orwell. And,
yeah.
And I mean, that's a book about the Cold War, but it somehow rings true today, even, you know, that it's long gone that time. I mean, do you think, because, I mean, the reason I bring this up is because your personal blog is called Thought Crime, right? Which is a thing from the book. I mean, how real is that kind of dystopia that Orwell painted there in that book today?
I think it is very real. The thing I'm scared about is that it may be even more real, but it may be even harder to detect because the systems are put in a way that it is not obvious that we live in that world. But if you look at the bigger picture and how people take decisions in the day to day, I think that's the most important part. Like, do people have entropy to take decisions? Do they take their own decisions? And if you look at that now, I think we are pretty close to that. With social media, for example, like it's crazy the way they can manipulate people and humans. And like their, for example, Facebook, their whole architecture is based around tricking your brain and knowing, you know, what are these substances they have to trigger in your brain to create certain reactions. And that's so, so, so scary. I don't think like even in 1984, they could have dreamed of that.
To me, it sometimes seems tame almost, that book. If you look at some of the things that happen, actually.
Yeah.
So who is the big brother, you think?
I think I also like this post called Moloch. And it talks about how there isn't like an evil in the world, but it's just like there are a lot of game theory glitches here and there that make everyone sort of go against themselves and like race to the bottom and be miserable. All the individuals, they have good incentives, like in common, they are just terrible. And I think it's kind of that. I would say a lot of times Big Brother is just like the peers, like multiple peers, and the way they organize themselves, and that's been miserable for everyone. I think a good example of that is social media, actually. Like everyone is sharing how happy they are with their food, and sometimes they are not, right? But they want to make to see that they are happy, and then other people feel unhappy because they are seeing how happy everyone else is, while in reality no one is happy. So that's kind of the scenario where I think because everyone is doing the same thing and being miserable without wanting to.
How did we get there?
That's so hard to answer. I would say that incentive misalignment is the most important part. If you're incentivized, in case of social media, you're incentivized to share how happy you are, but you are not incentivized to actually be happy, right? So I think this kind of incentive misalignments happening like everywhere, and that's where like dissonance happen, right? Because you should incentivize for certain things, but you're incentivized for the contrary sometimes.
Social media is one thing, but not everybody lives their life on social media, right?
Thankfully,
many people I know, they kind of turned off Facebook years ago already. So what else are maybe forces there that aren't going right?
I would think the government, for example, if you look at the incentives for corruption, or even if you look for, in general, how people react to politicians, like sometimes the incentive of the politician is very broken because even if they are corrupt, people don't care because they are able to use the money they get from corruption to get themselves more media attention and more marketing and therefore buy people's attention. And therefore, even if you are corrupt, it doesn't matter. You end up winning the elections. So I think that's also like another place where incentives are broken.
Mm-hmm. Before you mentioned, you know, the whole idea of work. And work is definitely maybe something that makes a lot of people unhappy as well, because they have to do something they don't enjoy. And they're kind of out of touch with, you know, with what they really would like to do in their life. I mean, what's your view on that?
I think that the closest we get to this utopia of machines working for us, and I think there was a lot of media and a lot of like dreams about this with sci-fi films and stuff like that, like years ago, decades ago, when people actually hoped for that day. And they have a lot of like, you know, like films about flying cars and stuff like that. And we don't have flying cars right now. We have social media. and I think that's a problem because we have lost our hopes that machines or like, you know, we will be able to automate a lot of these things that we don't like. We have lost hope of that. And now people are kind of on the other contrary extreme. They are like, we want our jobs and we want to have more jobs. And I think we should kind of like have this hope again that we will be able to do whatever we want and live our whole life in alignment and just be creative. Because if you look at what humans are good at, we are good at being creative. And being creative and being productive, sometimes that can go hand by hand.
But that's definitely a vision of Decentraland and also Aragon, that people can be more creative.
I think that they can be more humans, and that comes back to freedom. Like, you cannot be creative if you're not a human, and you cannot be human if you are not free, because that's the whole definition of a human, right? That's what differs ourselves from animals or other species. I would think so.
If, you know, imagine all these visions, you know, came true, that you have with Aragon and also Decentraland and also many other projects, you know, are very strong on this ideology that crypto and blockchain technology promises. How would you describe, you know, in just a few sentences, that kind of world if all these visions came true?
I would say it looks like smaller communities of people that really trust each other, and these communities interface with each other via some decentralized governance. Maybe they don't even know where each of these communities are because they interact using strong privacy tools and the internet. So maybe they don't even have to know about their existence. So everyone can be connected by the internet, but you don't necessarily have to know where all these people or entities are. So you cannot hurt them. You cannot go and use violence against them. I think that's kind of the high level overview. I think also like in general, being more privacy friendly, also more transparent. I think like sometimes those two can seem very, you know, kind of the extremes, and I think they are, but in different contexts, they are very useful. So I think like more transparency in the way we organize a society and more privacy in the way we live as individuals.
Mm-hmm. What about physical aspects of that world? Because most of what we're talking about now is always online, virtual code, right? How people interact. But what about, you know, physical manifestations of life? I mean, how do you see that change?
I think that we will live in smart communities that will be not so centered around cities. I think cities are monsters of the new age. they are.
Some people call them the greatest invention of humans.
Yeah, I think the opposite. It's actually crazy. And I have lived at big cities and small cities. And I think that, you know, like for a week or whatever, like it's super cool to be in big cities. But in general, if you look at the quality of life, if you look at like China, for example, and what's going on in there, it's crazy because like it's so hard to scale human societies, and it's hard to scale them in such a small space. So I think that people will be more in touch with nature again. I'm kind of concerned about that because like a lot of like the newer generations, they don't even like, they think that cows are purple or whatever. and so like there's a huge disconnection between nature and humankind. And I sort of feel that we will come back to being in these smaller communities and in contact with nature, and also like more healthy, right? Because like cities are clearly not the healthiest form of human organization.
I mean, yeah, you just mentioned something I wanted to ask, and that was that, you know, some people, young people, I mean, you were born in 1995, and so some maybe of your peers don't understand what nature even is or why they should like to be in nature. So, you know, we talked before also about these visions and how to align people and users with them. So when you look around, you know, in your peer groups, how many people do you think understand what you want to build here?
I don't think many of them. Actually, I think it's interesting because I think that a lot of the older generations actually understand crypto better because they have gone through terrible stuff in the governments that, you know, they saw when they were young, dictatorships or sorts and stuff like that. And I think younger generations, like at least in some like Western countries, we have grown in a totally like civilized environment and everything kind of worked. I mean, there are this corruption here and there, but like who cares? All politicians are the same, whatever. And so I think that kind of attitude has been very corrosive for our generations. So I actually think that we may not be super well positioned to understand this technology. But the few people who know, it's very cool because they know how to use technology. And they also know how to leverage it to create, you know, these crypto societies. And on the other hand, I think it's very cool that like my generation or even like younger generations, they like when they are born with the internet. And if you're born with the internet, there are things that you just cannot compute. Like, for example, I was going to Canada for a conference, and the day before I realized I needed a visa. And I was like, why do I need a visa to go to this country if I can send internet packets like, you know, instantaneously without needing a visa. So it's so like artificial for our generation to think about these barriers. So I think like there's still hope in our generation to build things. And if you look at the Ethereum ecosystem, a lot of people are super, super young and building a lot of cool stuff.
It's interesting. I mean, because I noticed that too, there's always when you look at some crypto meetup or some, you know, event, some Bitcoin event, there's always many people who are like 60 plus. And in other tech conferences, it's just not like that. Yeah. So I think that's a healthy and good development.
Yeah, you have both young people and you know, like not so young people, and that's cool.
Who are your role models?
That's a great question. I think it changes a lot, to be honest. I think this is so new. Like we are not running a startup, we are not running a business. This is so different. This is like a project. So I think it is super different. I think from the point of view of governance and sort of staying away from governance and being better neutral, I really like how Vitalik is doing it. He's been extremely neutral about a lot of things lately in Ethereum, and I think that's great because if not, people can see you as a dictator, even if you are not. So I really like his way of not clearly positioning for a lot of things and just letting the community be and decide.
Mm-hmm. So you said... some people think Vitalik is a dictator.
Yeah.
And that brings up another question I wanted to ask because George Orwell wrote another great book called Animal Farm. I'm sure you also
I haven't read it.
You haven't read it?
No.
It's a fantastic book. You should absolutely read it. It's, so I can't ask the question then.
Damn.
You have to read it because it addresses inequality and how that can corrupt society.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's a good book. I want to speak a little bit more about cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology in general. So how did you first get in touch with this?
I read about Bitcoin the first time in 2009 when I saw it for the first time, but I thought it was a scam. So then in 2011, I read the Bitcoin white paper and I discovered that it was not a scam. It was some very interesting technology. And I got into the Bitcoin community. I got into crypto in general. And then I would say in 2016 is when I really got into Ethereum. I was a bit late to the party, but I think it was super interesting for me to see that you can just create a smart contract to make it work. And for me, like in the early days of Bitcoin, that was kind of a problem. Like, okay, Bitcoin is cool, but how do you build things that are not strictly payment systems? And so Ethereum was a huge realization.
Mm-hmm. And what happened between that realization and founding or starting Aragon?
Well, it was a bunch of things. It was, first of all, basically the world going to shit with like Donald Trump winning the elections and a bunch of other stuff and the NSA scandals and all of that. And also we were running, Jorge, my co-founder and me, we were running a company to fight against patent trolls, which are a huge problem in the US. They patent a lot of stupid ideas and they sue people out of them. And so we wanted to end with that. What we realized, though, is that the government actually doesn't want to end that problem because there are hidden incentives, there are lobbying powers, and so they are comfortable with it. So then we realized we cannot solve this problem without solving the underlying problem, which is governance is broken at a micro and also at a macro level.
Mm-hmm. What are you still learning today? Or what was the latest thing that surprised you about Ethereum and this technology in general?
I would say that we need to focus on a lot of things because there are so many things that can be worked on that we need to like pick a few. Even if in Ethereum, there are so many things. So as an individual, I think it's very important to have that focus. As a community, of course, we have to explore a lot of things. But as an individual, we need to like pick the stuff that we want to work on and work on during years because it's going to be probably a 10-year marathon.
Mm-hmm. And in running Aragon, the project, what are you still learning there?
Well, I'm learning how to decentralize governance. For example, I'm not a leader anymore. I just dropped my project lead title and I'm just like now director of the or CEO of the Aragon One company, which is one of the companies working on Aragon's development. But we want to involve more. And so what we are learning is how can we level the project ground for other teams to go and join and have a say in the project. So it's not like just Jorge and me anymore. It's just like a bunch of other people contributing. So I think decentralized governance is like the most important and trying to dog food and try to apply that to ourselves. That's what we are really learning right now.
Mm-hmm. And just more of the daily business of an entrepreneur. I mean, what are things there that you feel should go better?
I think, again, it's focus. Like, it's just crazy the amount of input that you get. And as the project, gets big and you have more attention and you have more users and people, you get more and more inputs. And, like, saying no, this can sound like super cliche, but it's super important. Saying no to, like, 99% of the things is so, so, so important and crucial.
Louis, that was really great. Thanks a lot for your insight into your company and your ideas about the future. I really appreciate your taking time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.